Well, we've come a long way. We've covered a number of issues. We've had a lot of insight from a number of different perspectives. Who better to bring this together for us than someone who is currently working with a consulting firm called EcoConsult, Inc., who has worked closely on the World Water Vision, making water everybody's business, who is a former vice president of the World Bank, past president of the World Water Council, served as chairman of the International Steering Committee of the Dialogue on Water and Climate. Who better than someone who has interesting experience to the north of our border, where he was president of the Bureau d'audience publique de l'environnement du Québec. In 2001, someone with an honorary doctorate from McGill University's Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences. 2004, an honorary fellow of UNESCO IHE Training Institute. Who better than Bill Cosgrove? It's a great pleasure for me to ask him to come up and give some of his reflections on this journey that we've made together.
Well, they are just that, they're reflections, so they may be a bit disjointed. I've been listening to the speakers all day, and I decided that I would at least try to organize around each of the themes that's been discussed today. John Briscoe talked first on the implications for development and growth, and he described how managing water, harnessing water, contributes to development, not just production of food, which it did, but improving the quality of life, making education possible, all the things that we're seeking in the development objectives. He didn't mention, but I will, and we say so in the latest World Water Development Report, there has never been any development that took place without managing water. There has never been. And country after country is learning that. We heard in the presentation from China how they are doing the analysis, and they see they cannot develop until they manage their water. What often puzzles me is we know this, and yet it doesn't happen, and I don't understand why, because it pays so well. And economically, to invest in water is a good thing to do. I mean, here in the U.S., the Corps of Engineers, for every dollar they have invested in the water infrastructure in the U.S., has paid $6 in economic benefits. So why do we hesitate so much to put the money in? If we look at water supply and sanitation, WHO is telling us now that for every dollar invested, you can get 10, 20, even 30 times the return in economic terms. So I don't know why they don't. John started by presenting this water and saying it's a local problem. Yes, it is a local problem. We manage water locally. But we've already seen that there are parts of the world that don't have enough water. And while the term virtual water maybe has recently been coined, the reality is that for years, for example, in the Middle East, they have been importing products that were produced with somebody else's water. They import as much from outside as the Nile River would produce in the same period of time. So it's already an important thing that's happening. John raised the question, or he raised the point, about the moral hazards of giving advice and how easy it is to destroy something that's there, and how difficult to replace it. And, you know, should we give advice? Are we convinced that the way we've done things is the best way, and that if we had to do it again, we'd do it the same way today? I don't know. On the availability, the distribution, and the control of water for agriculture, I will start by saying we don't know. I mean, we don't know. We don't know how much we have. We don't know when we have it. We don't know about, and it hasn't been mentioned, I don't think, often enough, we don't know what's happening to the quality. Water that is polluted to the point where it's not economically reusable is just as good as water that doesn't exist anymore. We've taken it out of circulation for all practical purposes. The uses of water, the question of that was being, how much water is embedded in the various products, we don't know. What about the future? Herr Beckham showed us all these trends over the last 50 years. Where are they taking us? What do we know about them? So, if you're a decision maker, with all those unknowns, how do you decide? How do you decide? Maybe, as John said, this is, I forget the term he used, but anyway, it has to be. And in dealing with water, it's an evolutionary and an adaptive process. But then we have to recognize that that's the way it is too, and be monitoring it and be aware of it, and be close to it, that problem all the time. So virtual water, by the way, is a solution for countries that can afford it. But if you happen to be water poor and at the same time economically poor, you can't afford to get it. And so it's not the answer for everyone unless we're looking at this issue as a global issue. And I'd like to come, I will come back to that later. Then the next subject was the political economy of water and infrastructure. And one of the speakers put up the two words at the top of the slide, politics, right, and economics. They're there, the two of them, and we're trying to balance them. And how do we do that? We have worked now for a number of years with integrated water resource management. Is that integrating water and politics? And who's accountable for making decisions? That issue was also raised. Who's accountable for decisions? We know we want the public to participate. We want everyone to participate in the process. But if you want people to participate, you have to offer them, they have to have choices. And they have to have something to say about what the choices will be that are going to be made. Somebody else said private sector has to be involved because government can't. We had at least one private sector speaker today who is involved. We can be thankful for that. But maybe there need to be more. I think the leaders in the private sector make some big decisions about where to locate. And we're hearing more and more that they're taking account of where water is when they're making those decisions. They maybe pay more attention than our governments do. The issue of pricing came up several times, and you know, I think this is an unresolved problem. We haven't dealt with it yet. We haven't figured out how to deal with this problem of pricing water. Everybody seems to agree that water has some value and that we have to have some way of reflecting it in our processes. So why is it that we haven't been able to figure it out yet? How do we do it? Of course, we have to take account of the ability of people to pay. There are some people who can pay very little for water. So how do we build that into the process? And we had somebody else now who's telling us, and they're probably right, we have to build in a value of carbon and a value into this process as well. How to do all this? I think it's probably one of the key areas that we're going to have to resolve. Question came up of entitlements and allocation, requiring a legal framework. I think this has been a badly neglected area too. We can't, unless there is a legal framework to bring some validity to the processes that are in place, it's not going to work. So, and I think there needs to be more interaction between the water community and the legal community about where we're, how we're going to do these things so that they understand the practical sides of the laws that are being implemented or the regulations. And finally, I don't think there were any speakers at all today who really focused on the issues of transboundary waters, but all of the problems that we discussed today go in spades when you have a number of countries involved in taking the decision. And water and agriculture and the USA in foreign assistance. And I will expand a little bit, perhaps beyond the USA. I think it was in that session that there was a mention of the TVA as a multi-purpose project, an example that everybody would like to learn from in the world outside, and that when they come looking for advice, that's what they want to learn about. And I think it's this aspect of the fact that it was a multi-purpose project. I'm not sure what the links were with agriculture. I'm not familiar enough with the valley. Maybe Jerry Galloway, who's here, could tell us that. But I do know that it produced electricity that was used for the rural farm electrification program in the United States. And that made a big difference to agriculture. AID said that they're working in food security, water for the poor, and climate change, and that when there's enough money available in the pot, that then they can cooperate on it, but when it's all broken up into pieces, that they can't. And so the question that comes to me is, what is the share of assistance to the water sector out of the total assistance budget of the United States or other countries? And in the World Water Development Report, we point out that 4% of total official development assistance goes to the water sector, and that includes the infrastructure for irrigation. 4%. It's to me, given what I know about the importance of water to development, it doesn't make sense. On the other hand, it seems that that's the way governments that are receiving the money are setting their priorities too. So we can't just blame the aid community. The requests have to come from the countries themselves. I noted a couple of weeks ago that Robert Zelnick from the bank had suggested that 0.7, just as countries have committed to giving 0.7% of their GDP for development, that 0.7% of the money being set aside to deal with the financial crisis should be given to developing countries to help them deal with the problem in their countries. And I think, again, I come back to water. Water should be a priority. And imagine what 0.7% of $1 or $2 trillion in the United States devoted to the water sector and channeled through the aid system, what a difference that would make. It certainly would make enough available that you wouldn't have the problem of trying to coordinate between different objectives. And money is needed for infrastructure, but I don't think enough emphasis has been put on developing the capacity in the water sector itself. It needs to be there. The institutions have to be there. The laws have to be there. Trained people have to be there. The research has to take place. And I don't think we should neglect either the need to invest in education. There have been several speakers who've talked about population growth and other things that are causing water demand to increase. Population growth and increasing consumption are a question of education. It's been well demonstrated that girls who are educated become women who have fewer children, and that's going to be one of the contributions to the slowing down of population growth. And at the same time, better educated people can participate. We want people to participate in these public processes. They need a minimum of education to do that. Water and agricultural competitiveness. I wasn't sure in the title if we were talking about competition for water or competing for markets. And competing for markets for agriculture these days just doesn't seem to make sense to me. We're competing for what market? As I understand it now, the world's food stocks are down to a matter of a few weeks. So there's no market. The market what's the term I'm looking for? The market is completely open. It can't be saturated. You can sell all that you can produce. So competition is not there. I think the issue is rather some process for looking at the global stocks of food and where they are going to be produced. The example of China, when we looked at the enormity of the size of the requirements in China, let's suppose that China had a 10% shortfall in its production in a year, and that, heaven forbid, somewhere in the producing countries in Argentina or North America or Australia, there were simultaneous droughts. It would be a catastrophe. And it's time that we started thinking about, if that's a market, that's a market. Call it what you want, but we need to think about it in those terms, I think. I think we need to think about water more in trade negotiations. It's clear now. And if I mentioned earlier, and I said I'd come back to it, a poor country that's poor in water and economically poor at the same time, how are they going to be able to buy? Are we going to give it to them? Or better still, can we not in trade negotiations think about these countries and say, well, how can we help them to produce goods that they can sell to earn the foreign exchange that they need to import their food that contains water that they don't have? I don't know what benefits you give them, but there are all kinds of issues around tariffs and barriers of these kinds that I'm sure could facilitate that kind of activity. And technology in water and infrastructure. There are all kinds of technology that were described for us, especially the wide range of options that are available for irrigation. The possibilities of GMOs, of genetic modifications in general, of research in the agricultural field. And there's a tendency to think about that in terms of the way we think about research here. But in developing countries, they have to have the capacity themselves to take that research, maybe build on it. They have to learn it, to adapt it to their own countries. They have to build their own extension capacity. It was the extension service in the U.S. that helped the farmers to make to adapt to the new ways of doing things. Where are the extension services coming in the developing countries? They have to have them. I was really encouraged by the presentation by NASA because there's all kinds of things there. I go back to what we don't know about water, and of course the technology that she described is one of the ways that we can fill that void. We still need ground proofing, but we need that technology offers, I think, a hope in that area. Someone else talked about fertilizer and water, and I know of a case in Mali where farmers were asked, if you have a choice between we provide you with fertilizer now or we tell you when the rain will start, which would you prefer? They would much rather know when the answer was we want to know when the rain is going to start. There's no use in buying fertilizer if we don't know when to plant our crops. It was much more important to them. And then to conclude, building on what Herr Bergkamp said, on the future of water and future of agriculture. It's clear from the presentations that we heard that if we just continue doing things the way we've been doing them, we're going to be in deep trouble. But at the same time, each of the speakers, I think, has provided us with some options about ways out, about things that we can do. So it doesn't have to happen. We don't have to have to live that future. It's going to require, as Herr said, it's going to require all of us to work together with all of the knowledge communities. The problem is, at the forum, they made an effort at the international level to bring other people into the process. We don't have the people that really make the decisions in this room. We're talking to each other. It's been, for me, wonderfully informative, and I'm sure it has been for you too. But the real decision makers are sitting on Capitol Hill or somewhere nearby in their offices. Those of us in this room, we can inform them, we can advise them, we can implement what they decide should be done, but we don't make the decisions. And so, I think this has been a wonderful day. Thank you to GEIS and to CSIS. And I would encourage you, though, to repeat this event and repeat it over and over again with the right people in the room. Thank you.
Well, now falls on me to conclude here. Let me do it by making five very brief points. The first is that when we got together with our counterparts at SAIS, after Dean Einhorn wisely declared this to be the academic year of water here, we put together a list of dream team individuals. And I have to tell you how thrilled we were when the vast majority of the people that we thought would be wonderful to have with us today were actually able to come. And we're deeply grateful to the speakers who have been here today, many of whom traveled a long way and managed to put aside other commitments to contribute to our deliberations here today. The second point, and let me repeat what Jessica Einhorn mentioned earlier, we're grateful for the collaboration of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Number three, I'd like to acknowledge on behalf of CSIS, Rachel Posner did a lot of work to make today's proceedings possible, and we're deeply grateful to her for that. And she and I really had a wonderful time working with our counterparts here at SAIS, led by Jessica Einhorn, but working with Amir Pasek and Ashley Rogers, and a highly capable team that made today's proceedings possible. Congratulations to all of you. And the final point is thank you for sticking it out to the end of the day, all of you. We've had really quite a remarkable amount of points of view and insight on this critical issue, which I think binds all of us in one way or another, this issue, this challenge, and this opportunity that is global water. And I think Bill is absolutely right when he argues that we have to meet time and time again to think through many of the big issues that continue to be unresolved in one way or another. It's incumbent on all of us to try to push the envelope when it comes to understanding this critical resource. So, Jessica, I don't know if you'd like to say anything else, but we're very grateful to all of you, and with that, we conclude this conference. Thanks very much for being with us today.